all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
And here we are for another, another edition of Veterans Radio Live, coming to you from WAAM Talk 1600. That's right, AM. People go, hey man, what are you on the AM for? Well, that is the medium that is bringing so much of community and local broadcasting, and now with internet. And by the way, if you are or haven't, you can go to www.veteransradio.net. And you can go there anyway. You know, we got a whole lot of good stuff on there, archives and all, and everything that we've been a part of goes on our website. You can also listen to, if you're having a little problem, sometimes AM, hey, I only got it in my car, man. Well, then you can go to our internet set and click on listen to, right? You can get that and hear that nice and clear. We got a great program today. We're going to be talking about World War II. Oh man, there's World War II. Well, you know, it's the 70th anniversary. 70 years since the end of World War II. I have two, they've been guests before on Veterans Radio, two authors who are, going to give us all that background that we're gonna, these guys are terrific. I've seen them on the Military Channel, I've seen them on the History Channel, I've seen them and heard them. That, oh boy, I just can't, it's one of my favorite subjects is World War II. I can't wait to get into it. I want to say also to my partners, Dale and Jim, who are on other assignments elsewhere in this universe. So they'll be back next week. It's just me and my board op. I'm going to call him Redline. Redline, Red Zone. Derek, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Bob.
Okay. Redline, folks. Redline. All right. We got a couple little things to do here. Reese Across America. A lot of folks wanted to know how can we get in touch with Reese Across. Then that's something when you're listening to Veterans Radio, always want to have a writing stick and a piece of paper because we give a lot of information out. And what's really cool about Reese Across America, if you have an area, cemetery, what, that you want to have wreaths placed on. How do you do all this? Well, here's how you do it. You go to Wreaths, Wreaths, AcrossAmerica.org. WreathsAcrossAmerica.org. Go there and all the information is available. They'll help you get something started. It's really cool. Way cool. And a great organization. I think they've been around about 8 or 9 years. What else do we have here? Oh, yes. Legacy. PTSD Legacy. There's going to be an Agent Orange town hall meeting every week. We're talking about this because it's very important. On Saturday, May 9th, Northville High School. And it's going to be a number of speakers and folks that are going to be talking about PTSD. And I don't want to get into a whole lot of this. Some of the speakers is U.S. Congressman Dave Trott, Pat Kolbeck, he's a Michigan State Senator, and from the Vietnam Veterans of America, Agent Orange, right out of there. But anyway, they're going to be talking about, it's only about 4 hours, so it's really cool, and there's going to be refreshments and all that. But they're going to be talking about the legacy, not just about Agent Orange, but the legacy of Agent Orange. Generations to come, generations now and generations to come. So we're going to be covering that. That's right. At Veterans Radio Net. That's right. Veterans Radio Network. So we're going to be covering that from gavel to gavel, and the future of our offspring depend on it. Absolutely. Legacy. What else do we have here? We have another one, a book coming out and tomorrow, the 20th, over at the Plymouth Library. Make sure I get Plymouth District Library. Hey man, why is he telling us about all? Well, you know, if you're listening to Wham Talk 1600 and you can hear this on the AM, that means you're close to Plymouth, Michigan. That's right. So tomorrow at 1:30, April 20th, they're going to be talking about a book here, and I want to get it right, Snowblood's Journal, an American novel about men and dogs in Vietnam. And, you know, a number of the dogs never came back. I know they have, there were 3,747 dogs used in Vietnam. Only 204 exited the country. Oof. So they're, we had somebody on that not too long ago, and there were reasons for that. Obviously, some were killed in combat situations, but they also become very attached to their owners. And anyway, so that's going to be tomorrow at the Plymouth Library, District Library at 1:30. Once again, Snowblood's Journal, an American novel about men and dogs in Vietnam. And I'm reading some of the reviews. Early reviews call this book, quote, a wild ride on foot and by chopper through a war. Tense, tight, lyrical, wonderfully told. Meet the author in person tomorrow at the Plymouth District Library at 1:30. Okay, time to get with our authors right after this very important message. Red Line, take it.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans' Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Be a hot time in the town of Berlin when the Yanks go marching in. I want to be their boy, spread some joy when they take old Berlin. There'll be a hot time in the town of Berlin when the Brooklyn boys begin to take the joint apart and tear it down when they take old Berlin. They're gonna start a row and show 'em how we paint the town back in Kokomo. They're gonna take a hike through Hitler's Reich and change that hile to what you know, Joe. There'll be a hot time in the town of Berlin when the Yanks go marching in. You could never keep 'em happy down on the farm after they take Berlin.
Yeah. There'll be a hot time in the town of Berlin when the Yanks go marching in, and we certainly did. But, many years ago, 70 years, we're coming up to the anniversary of the end of the war in Europe, was in May of 1945. Okay, by the way, that was by Bing Crosby and the Andrews Sisters. And they were very, very, both of those, as well as other entertainers, were very instrumental in, sorry for the pun. excuse me on that one, folks. Okay, they were very, very, very much all the entertainers apart. Movie stars, Clark Gable, and went into, I think he was in the Air Force or the Army Air Corps, and they all, they entertained the troops, so. Thanks to Bing Crosby and Andrew's Sisters. Okay, now let's take on World War II. One of our guest authors today is Professor John C. McManus. He's a professor of military history at Missouri University of Science and Technology. Professor McManus has written numerous books on World War II, and he's also served as a member of the editorial board of World War II magazine. Professor McManus, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hi, Bob. How are you today?
Oh, we're doing great. Thank goodness for the sunshine. Oh, Lord. And you're in where? Washington?
I'm in St. Louis, where it's currently raining, unfortunately.
Ooh, okay. Well, better weather's coming. Anyway, my second guest, and by the way, Professor McManus has been on our program many times in the past, and we're going to just have a great time today talking all about all these little facts of World War II. Our second guest today is Kevin Hemel. Kevin Hemel is a historian for the U.S. Army Combat Studies Institute. He writes military history narratives on the war in Afghanistan. He's also the author of Patton's Photographs and Patton, legendary World War II commander. He's also appeared on the History Channel, on Military Channel, Fox News Channel, Book TV, speaking about Patton, and including World War II and World War II history, Army and military heritage. He's presently working on a book focusing exclusively on General Patton's experiences during World War II, entitled Patton's War. Ooh, I got a lot to ask Kevin today. He holds a master's degree in American history from Villanova University. Welcome to Veterans Radio, Kevin.
Hey, great to be here, Bob. How you doing?
I'm doing great, and we're ready to get this thing started. Okay, wow. You know, I was just talking to my board op. Where do you start on World War II? Where do you start? So I'm gonna go back to 1914 and start right there, because that's when I think all of this, all the characters, and it was all being shaped. And 1914, when Germany invaded France, And we had this terrible World War I and all the casualties, and there was one casualty, a corporal who was an artist, and he was gassed, and he came out of it a disillusioned and very, 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 very angry person. There also was someone, oh, by the way, that was Adolf. And then there was also an air ace. And he went on to start the SS under Adolf Hitler, and he started the SS and many other things, and he was also in charge of the Nazi Air Force, Hermann Göring, and they all came out of World War I, and right after the war, being so disillusioned, Hitler was angry, he was mad, and he was trying to get the people fired up. This is wrong, communism's wrong, it's all wrong, and we're not, but there was prosperity. Right after World War I, there was huge prosperity. Yes, because we were loaning them a ton of money. We really built Germany with our money, and this could have been something, and I'm going to want Professor McManus to comment on that this could be where Hitler started to look at all the Jewish bankers and the big international bankers, because what changed, and by the way, Hitler tried all sorts of to get people rallied. He had his Nazi party, National Socialist Party, and they won like 0.5% of the vote, and they were going nowhere, nobody was listening to him. Then came the American Depression, 1929, and the bankers, here's our bankers again, called in all their notes, and Germany collapsed. Perfect. Now, for Hitler, who did a little time in prison, wrote his book, Mein Kampf, now he can be at the top. Tell us about that, Professor McManus.
Well, there's actually a couple of economic collapses in Germany after World War I. The initial years after the war were very, very chaotic and desperate in Germany, because, you know, really Germany loses World War I in part because it collapses internally and politically. The government falls from power, people are hungry, people are desperate. Of course, they've suffered terrible casualties. The infrastructure has been taxed to its limits, and the currency as well. And so really for about the first 3 to 4 years, if not even 5 years after the war, these are hungry, desperate economic times, which partially leads to paramilitary groups fighting in the streets and whatnot. And also, and then maybe this is the most famous aspect of it, the complete collapse of the German currency, which leads to, as you mentioned, American bankers, what was called the Dawes Plan, putting together an effort to kind of stabilize the German economy. And then this creates better economic times for about the next 3 to 4 years, and thus not very fertile ground for the Nazis or the communists to take power. But of course, once the Great Depression happens in 1929 and thereafter, the second economic collapse, which is much worse than the first, obviously it does create the kind of conditions that make it possible for either the Nazis or the communists to take power. Because really, you have these two extremist parties trying to come to power and really fighting in the streets by the early 1930s, and the Nazis prevail.
And a loaf of bread was 30,000 marks.
And more.
And more.
People were people were, you know, wheelbarrowing their paychecks home.
That's unbelievable.
They were using, you know, bricks of marks to heat themselves in the winter. And it was a, you know, of course, a terrible situation that had to be stabilized. But it was all, you know, as you had mentioned, you know, dating back to 1914. Of course, all this is a product of World War One. So World War Two, obviously, is just the ultimate sequel of World War One. It's not going to happen if not for the events of World War One. And certainly, Hitler and the Nazis are never going to rise to power if you don't have World War One and all the crises that it unravels or puts into motion. And also, it collapses the old order, the old aristocratic order in Europe, and that creates new conditions that the Nazis can prevail.
Now, Kevin,
yes.
Where was Patton all this time?
Patton is back in the United States, originally training with tanks, but the United States Army just does not have the money for a tank corps, so they dissolve it, and so he goes back to the cavalry. And the head of the cavalry, the general in charge of the cavalry, hated the idea of tanks so much that you weren't even allowed to use the word tanks. You had to say armored cars. So Patton, wanting to get promoted and wanting to stay loyal to his superiors, stopped talking about tanks, stopped theorizing about them, and enjoyed himself in the horse cavalry. He was stationed twice in Hawaii, but spent most of his time in either Fort Riley in Kansas or at Fort Myer, Washington, D.C.
I was at Fort Riley. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, it was. And
they have a nice museum there to the cavalry.
Yes, they do. Absolutely do. Now, where was Eisenhower, Professor McManus?
Eisenhower was going through much the same kind of career path, except he was an infantry officer. And he was, of course, friends with Patton, and they had a lot of arguments over, you know, what would be the doctrine of the future and what would be the primary weapons of the future and how to advance it, but they were both relentless professionals in the sense. In order to stay in the Army in that period in the 20s and 30s when promotions were few and far between, you really did have to be a dedicated officer. So Eisenhower will kind of rotate among a number of rather anonymous assignments, I think the most interesting of which happens immediately after World War One, when he's part of a group that's studying roads and road building in America, and they went on a coast-to-coast trip, I think it was either the summer 1919 or 1920, just to kind of test how long it would take to go coast-to-coast in this country, and I think it took them the better part of 3, 4, 5 weeks, and the road net was bad, and of course this made a deep impression on Eisenhower, and that in tandem with the German road system under the Nazis in the 1930s and 40s and what he saw with that in World War II, is one of the major reasons why he's going to spearhead the Interstate Highway Act in the 1950s when he's president.
Now, I had heard that one of the reasons that he did the Interstate Highway Act was also to have a way to move troops from one area to another. Is that true?
Well, there's no question, right? And, of course, you know, all this is happening in the context of the Cold War, and then some would argue perhaps the height of the Cold War, you know, in the mid to latter 1950s when tensions were high. And Eisenhower understood that you had to have a good infrastructure, a good road net to move troops and vehicles and missiles and tanks and whatever else. And, of course, you'll often hear, with enough with enough frequency to believe that there's some truth to it, you have a lot of straightaways in any typical interstate highway stretch of road. And one of the reasons for that is so that aircraft could land on, especially rotary-winged aircraft, which are in play by that point, too. So,
I had heard that, and that's true. Is that right?
As I understand it, there is truth to that, and it certainly makes sense. I mean, but I don't know that the builders are able to always do that with a kind of, regimented circumstance. Every road is different. But wherever they could, they are putting straightaways, and not just for that, but because it's easier to drive, too, and safer.
Well, just don't do that on I-75 at 5 o'clock. No. Okay, so Adolf Hitler gets elected. He, after serving some time, he was sprung. I think he got 5 years, 10 years on, but he was sprung after only a few months. Because why, Professor?
Well, one thing I'll point out is he's never really quite elected into power. They had a multi-party coalition parliamentary system in Germany called the Weimar Republic. And the Nazis had gotten a plurality of the vote by the early 1930s, and this would be, you know, maybe in the realm of about 30%. And so he's chosen by the present government, Paul von Hindenburg's government, to head up a kind of coalition government in the number one position as chancellor. So it's a bit different than our system where we directly elect a president. And he emerges as this kind of multi-party leader and then, of course, quickly takes steps to amass all power in his hands, you know, from 1933 onward. But why has he sprung from prison so early? Well, he had been convicted of treason for attempting to overthrow the government, what's called the Beer Hall Putsch, in November 1923. And this had failed, had been put down by the Bavarian authorities in Munich. And nonetheless, many in the Bavarian government had a great deal of sympathy with Hitler's nationalistic ideas, certainly his anti-Semitism, and the idea that the Treaty of Versailles that had, you know, ended hostilities in World War One had been grossly unfair to Germany. So he's allowed to use the trial as what we would think of as almost a political infomercial now. And when he goes to prison, he gets a very nice, you know, executive prison kind of set up in Landsberg, writes his famous memoirs, Mein Kampf, and then his sentence is eventually commuted because he has so many friends in high places in the Department of Justice in Bavaria.
Well, he gets elected, and the, what is his name, Hindenburg, he dies, and all of a sudden, Hitler becomes the head because of the party. His party was in power. Now he's the guy in charge. And he really doesn't, you know, there were little things going on. We're not even going to get into it at this point, folks, because I want to get to the meat of World War II. But he then starts to do his, wow, you know, I wonder, his world plan. And he starts with annexing the Sudetenland. And what else did he do, Professor?
Well, the first major thing he does is he directly goes against the Treaty of Versailles, which had said that Germany needed to have a small army, no real air force or navy to speak of. It was not to have its own military forces on what's called the Rhineland, which is basically the area from which you would invade France. So you can understand why that would be, you know, in the treaty. So he's already decided he's going to go against that and begin rearming Germany and to kind of try and alleviate the Treaty of Versailles. And so first major thing that he does is to remilitarize the Rhineland in March 1936, which is of course, a major issue for France, because they're the ones most likely to be affected by it, and also Belgium, too. No one wants war at that point. France is in the throes of the Depression. It has internal political disputes. It has a Popular Front socialist government, which does not want to rearm and go to war. And so Hitler kind of gets away with this when he was weaker, probably militarily, than France and Britain. And this raises his political standing in Germany at every turn. And so eventually, of course, this leads to the annexation of Austria in 1938, and as you mentioned, the Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia in 1938.
So now he's popular, and the German people are now, the roads are being built, and he made the trains run on time, and unemployment, he did all these public works programs and started building all his monuments and all that other business that he was so, and he was putting people back to work. There was no, I mean, the unemployment was zilch, and as things are coming up, and then all of a sudden, he decides to go after Poland. Kevin, tell us about that. Why did he invade Poland?
Why did Adolf Hitler invade Poland? I think simply he wanted what he called Lebensraum, was elbow room. And he was aiming for places that were weak, and he had already gone into Czechoslovakia and Austria, which had been the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And he figured, you know, with invading Poland, he could obtain more land. I don't think he thought he was strong enough yet to invade France. And, of course, he makes the famous pact with Stalin, agreeing to divide Poland between the two of them if he goes in, and that just kind of gives him a free hand to do as he wants. And this kind of turns to be the sort of test case for blitzkrieg warfare. And I think no one really, in Adolf Hitler included, appreciated what tanks could do on a battlefield. And the fact that they just brought so much mobility to warfare and ended major campaigns so quickly, where everyone was so used to trench warfare and protracted warfare, Poland kind of left everyone, you know, almost dazed and confused how quickly German forces were able to overrun their territory, you know, as opposed to the Russian ones, and capture, surround Warsaw. It was just this sort of iron-fisted blast that nobody was expecting. And I think it made the Western allies almost quake in their boots what Germany was able to do so quickly, you know, in the east, that he would soon be turning his armies west and doing the same.
So what did Patton say? I told you so?
No, but he was definitely making notes because, like I had mentioned, he had sort of turned away from armored warfare and went back into the cavalry. And when he saw what tanks were doing in Europe, he started sitting up and taking notice, which is something he was going to do for the rest of the war. He always, anytime he saw a new German tank on the battlefield, he would take pictures, analyze them, realize what improvements had been made, and would send them back to Aberdeen, where the where scientists were constantly upgrading tanks. But it really was the war games that George C. Marshall begins in the United States, where Patton was actually a referee, and he saw what an armored unit could do, that he then extricated himself from cavalry, was made a brigade commander in an armored division, and, you know, kind of took all that accumulated knowledge he had from World War I and started applying it to the sort of awakening American army prior to Pearl Harbor.
Well, we're setting the stage, folks, here. It's all the players are coming in the line, and we've got about, what, 30 seconds, Big Cat? All right, Derek says we got 30 seconds. So we'll be right back right after the news and a couple of other important messages with Kevin Hemel and Professor John McManus. World War II. Now we're going to get to the meat of everything. That's what's really cool. Yeah, I got to get the chance. We're going to talk some more about this Leavis round. Okay? You'll be in the know if you stay right here on Talk 1600 WAAM. Don't go away. Conway Truckload honors the service of American military men and women with an apprenticeship program that allows veterans to use the GI Bill to supplement their income during their first year driving, as well as tuition reimbursement when they begin. Conway Truckload wants to continue the tradition of service right here at home. To learn more, call 866-WORK-FOR-US or visit online truetoblue.com/military.
Trinidad, they make you feel so very glad. Calypso sing and make up rhyme, guarantee you one real good fine time. Drinking rum and Coca-Cola, go down Point Cumana, both mother and daughter, working for the Yankee dollar.
Rum and Coca-Cola, the Andrews sisters. Once again, a little something from World War II. Now, getting back to my guest, Kevin Hemel and Professor John McManus. Now we can get into the whole meat of everything. Okay, Warsaw, Poland, been conquered, and he's top. Adolf is at the top of the of his game. They he promised that he would not be in war. I don't know how he got away with the with the Poland thing, but he promised that there would be no more. The people loved him. Everything was really cool for Adolf. The economy was working. They now he had the beginning of Lebensraum. And then what happens? This is my list of events in World War II, I think. In my opinion, when he turns around, 1941 June, he invades Russia. Yes, all Russia, big Russia. I mean, this guy had to be insane. Look at the board. Oh, good. Tell us all about that, Professor McManus.
Well, the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany were implacable enemies in spite of the Nazi-Soviet pact, which was just a kind of arrangement of convenience at the moment. In 1939, when they signed that pact, it gives Hitler the opportunity to fight World War II on one front, at least temporarily, because he knew invading Poland would probably lead Britain and France to declare war on him, and certainly it did. So Hitler wants to shore up an eastern flank without having to fight. And Stalin knew the Soviet Union was nowhere near prepared for war, so he wanted to buy time. But both were really plotting to betray each other almost as soon as the ink was dry on that thing. So, Hitler's entire blueprint from the beginning was, as you said, Lebensraum, living space, and that was going to come in the east for the German people. He envisioned a vast empire, really a slave empire, of German colonization stretching as far, really, as the Ural Mountains, far east of Moscow. And so it all made sense in that respect, but obviously it was not a wise decision. You could argue it's the key moment of World War II, and then, of course, subsequently, after Pearl Harbor, later that same year, 1941, he elects to declare war on the United States, which, of course, changes the dynamic of the war.
And in the beginning, folks, the Russian prisoners, they were surrendering hundreds of thousands at a time. The lines, hundreds of thousands. But the Russian soldiers at that point, a lot of them, I think, were just throwaways. They were Mongols, etc. And I do believe, and we'll get to this in just a little bit, that Stalin saw all this and he was scared. He said, "What's going on here?" But that had to be insane. That really had to be insane for Adolf Hitler to think that he could control a country the size of Russia and overextend his army. But he moved on, pushed on to Leningrad, Stalingrad. He had his tanks. He was rolling. He was going to the Caucasus. He was going to the oil. He was pushing across Russia, expending troops, expending all his energy, moving. And the Russians are being defeated. They're falling back. Now, Kevin, what did Patton think about all this?
Well, this is what Patton's idea of war was, a sort of total war with armor in the front, with the infantry, behind, and the armor would sort of, what they called it, haul ass and bypass. And basically, you would drive your tanks through the heavy enemy resistance, cut them off from their supply lines, their communications, and then have the infantry come up, surround, and destroy them. And the belief was that, it was fact, that as you would isolate these units with armor, that their morale would drop because they realized they were surrounded, and so you would have a psychological advantage over your enemy. And so Patton paid close attention to this and studied it. Ironically, the Germans took such heavy losses by the end of their first year in the Soviet Union with so many losses in tanks, that they reorganized the panzer or armored divisions in the German army, and the American army copied this, thinking this was the most efficient way to deploy armor, when really the Germans were just reacting to their loss of so many tanks.
Now,
so we kind of misinterpreted what was going on there.
In December of 1941, that's when Stalingrad, that's when it all started, folks, and the original siege of Stalingrad, which was concluded in 1942 in the winter. So here's the German army now, and what comes along? It's better than a weapon. It was called the Russian winter, the Russian weather. Here is the German army now pushing into Russia, and here it's 1941 in the wintertime, 41-42. Tell us about that, Professor McManus.
Right, the Russian winter was absolutely brutal that first year for the German armed forces in 1941 and 42. The Germans suffered about 900,000 casualties that first year alone, which many of which, of course, could not be replaced. And the armed forces, by about October and November, are in a situation where they've gone deep into Russia, and logisticians are having to choose among basically two out of three vital things: food, ammo, or warm clothing for the approaching winter, because the Russian road net was so bad, German armies are so deep into Russia, so on and so forth. And obviously they choose food and ammo. So the Germans are very ill-prepared for the winter at that point, and pay the price for it in front of Moscow. Now, the next year, when Stalingrad happens, which is from about September of 42 through February of 43, they're better prepared for the winter. They certainly understood a lot about winter warfare, but that didn't make it all that much easier. And so this is something they deal with over the course of the entire war, 43 and 44, and then 44 and 45. But I think it's also possible to argue that the German experience with winter warfare prepares them better you know, for for adverse weather in the battle we call the Battle of the Bulge, which is the biggest American battle of the European theater, and much of which is fought in very difficult winter weather. So the Germans were probably better prepared for the U.S. Army at that point, too, because of the experiences they had in Russia.
Okay. Now, and I know I'm jumping, taking big blocks of time. We've got the Germans are pushing into Russia. They're going closer to Moscow. Some of the scout troops were talking about seeing the golden domes of the Kremlin through their binoculars. I mean, they were close, folks. They're coming in. And what happens? Pearl Harbor. The Japanese and the Americans. The Japanese attack America, of course, Pearl Harbor. And what does Hitler do? He declares war on the U.S. Tell us about that, Kevin.
Well, that was considered one of Hitler's greatest mistakes because the United States was attacked by Japan, and so we were contemplating a war with Japan, but how to declare war on Germany? Well, Adolf Hitler solved that problem by declaring war on us, which he did because of his alliance with Japan. But that was a little bit of a conundrum for Roosevelt at first, but Adolf Hitler solved it for him. And, of course, once that was done, the decision made in the War Department, and it was a very tough decision, was to follow a European-first strategy. Because although we've actually got fighting going on in the Philippines, Americans taking heavy casualties and eventually are going to be surrounded and have to surrender in the Philippines, the decision is this is the greater foe. This is the greater threat to the United States, Germany, because it is so much more technologically advanced from Japan. And in addition, it's the one that's hammering England, our great ally. And so the decision is made to put Germany as the priority with Japan as the second priority, and that's the way the war is going to go. That's going to be the main thrust of the United States through North Africa, Sicily, Italy. And then, of course, you're going to have D-Day in June 6, 1944, which is really going to start the breaking of the back of the Nazi war machine.
Well, I still, every time I think of this and I look at it, I think that was insane, along with the invasion of Russia, the fact that Professor McManus, what do you feel would have happened had he had not declared war on Germany, Hitler?
Certainly would have been a better go for Germany. But the reasoning behind it, I mean, it's possible to come to grips with it and understand it. Obviously, he's deep into his campaign in Russia, and though he's met with adversity that winter, 41-42, it's important to understand Germany is still in charge in the war. They control most of the continent. They've had the better of the fighting in North Africa against the British Commonwealth. German U-boats have been savaging Allied shipping in the North Atlantic and elsewhere. And so the way Hitler interpreted Pearl Harbor, he overestimated it. He felt that America's greatest asset, its Navy, had been basically taken off the board. And so now what he could do, he'd been fighting an undeclared war with the U.S. anyway in the fall of 41 in the Atlantic because of our Navy helping move supplies to Great Britain. And
Lend-Lease, right?
Yeah, Lend-Lease, exactly. So we were anything but a neutral, really. And so he felt, now I can take the gloves off, and now I can really marginalize the United States and strangle Great Britain at the same time, and then I'll probably be done with the war in Russia next year, which, of course, is over-optimistic, and then I'll be the master of Europe, and the Western allies can't do much. He really underestimated the American effect on the outcome of World War One, of course, too. So he underestimated the United States. This was a major mistake, but this is what he was thinking at the time. So I don't know if I'd call it insane, just a miscalculation, just a poor decision.
Well, a lot of insane people miscalculate, but let's get back to, okay, so now he's at war with the United States and he's at war with Britain, he's at war with France, he's at war with Russia. And he's extending himself. By the way, folks, Germany was really deficient when it came to transportation. They were still using horses and to move their equipment around. And eventually, that's going to come back and catch them because they weren't able to supply all these folks, all these troops that were going into Russia. Okay, so now we've got that. And Lebensraum, one more time. Kevin, a little bit more on that. I think that basically was where Hitler, and he got that from, I don't remember the person's name, the German who philosopher who originally came up with that idea. The idea, there was 80 million German people in Germany with a small country, and they needed room to expand. But why would you think that you're talking about a 1,000-year Reich, and you're trying to solve everything in the first 18 months? Tell us about that, Kevin.
Well, that was sort of a reason for expansion. It sort of was the justification for invading other countries, where it almost can be reduced to almost tribal angers and hatreds. The long-standing hatred of the French, who they had bested in the War of 1870 and had been fought to a standstill in World War I. They felt they were robbed of a victory there in the West. And then, of course, there was that belief that that Russians were genetically inferior to Germans, and then the fact that they became a communist society almost just embittered Hitler all the more. And so the sort of twisted logic is, if we can get rid of these inferior beings, it's going to free up the land for our superior Aryans. He had already started that within the borders of Germany, mostly with Jewish people and any other minority that was not of the body, I guess you could call it. And so the rationalization is, you know, we are the superior beings. We are destined to rule the world. These other inferiors are in our way. So all we have to do is clear them out. We'll take over the land. We'll create the breadbasket for ourselves to become a great country. And it was just this sort of twisted logic of the superiority of the Aryan brand.
Well, I remember my parents talking, they were not interventionists at all, period. In fact, my mother would talk about that there were 10,000, and she remember her using those 10,000 coffins stored by the United States because Roosevelt, and she called him Roosevelt, which is really the way to say it, instead of Roosevelt, but she, well, with disdain. And I think that also Hitler saw all that, but that all changed. My folks became patriotic once all this started, and Germany declared war. So I believe that had a big influence. Now, let's get back to, okay, they're knocking on the door of Moscow. And here it is, folks. This is the light. The lightning is coming. Here they are. They're 15 miles from Moscow. They're coming in, and the Russians find out through their spies that they're not going to be attacked by the Japanese. So they move those troops, I don't know, a million or something, 4,000 tanks, to right Moscow. They're right at, tell us about that, Professor McManus.
Right, they redeployed most of their Far Eastern army to the area around Moscow and launched a surprise counteroffensive in December 1941, right at the time when the German armed forces were really kind of reaching the limit of their endurance. So not only did they push them back from Moscow, they ripped a huge hole in the German front. The Germans then had to really scramble to patch it together, and Hitler famously did not authorize retreat and told them to hold the line and all the rest of it. So things are stabilized by the early months of 1942, but obviously it means the war will continue, and it changes the dynamic of the war and only adds to the casualty numbers. And, of course, at that time, Japan moves on the U.S. as well.
Well, here come the Russians, and they're prepared, and their troops are prepared, and they're clothed, and they're fed. We're not talking about the rabble that was used prior to that, the years before that were just thrown out there for sacrifice. So here come the Russians, and they're pushing the Germans back, pushing them back. Oh, man, there was this big tank battle at Kursk, and that went against the Germans, and now they're being pushed even further back, and they got, well, where are they going? And we got the Americans coming up from the other directions. They're caught. Now, what happened then, Kevin?
Well, basically, the German army that had so many hundreds of miles between the Western Command and the Eastern Command are basically starting to fight back-to-back. The invasion of June 6th is a huge success for the American army. Once Patton's Third Army becomes activated on August 1st, he just drives helter-skelter across parts of France, liberating cities and towns, terrifying the Germans. They're stuck in a pocket around a town called Falaise that is basically squeezed shut The Germans, some German soldiers do escape the pocket. And we really almost butt up against the border of Germany by the end of September. But German forces kind of rally, and they kind of fight us to a standstill. The American and British armies do run low on fuel and ammunition. So there's sort of a stalemate between October and November. And then, of course, Hitler's going to launch a huge counterattack. This is really Hitler and Germany's last gasp for any kind of success in the West. That is basically crunched up like a piece of paper in a fist, with a great deal of help from Patton driving up from the south to the north, first liberating Bastogne, which was surrounded with 101st and 10th Armored soldiers involved, and then closing off the entire bulge. Once that is accomplished, the entire American and British armies turn east and begin the race into Germany, and the last real barrier is the Rhine River. Now, Eisenhower has slated Montgomery, Field Marshal Montgomery in the north, to lead the attack across the Rhine River. His belief is that's where all the German industry is, and that's the most valuable target. And, of course, Patton is kind of very bitter about this, that Montgomery is going to lead the great attack. Well, it turns out to be the First Army under Courtney Hodges that surprisingly captures a bridge, the Ludendorff Bridge at Remagen, and they push an entire armored division across and then other units before the bridge actually collapses. But the Americans are the first one to make the cross. And then Patton rushes his 5th Infantry Division to the Rhine River. They arrived at night, and I've actually talked to some of the soldiers in the unit, and they said usually when you get to a river, you know, the trucks pull up or you run up to the river and you wait about 24 hours while they bring boats up. Some of the soldiers from the 5th Infantry said when they arrived at the Rhine River, there were already boats waiting for them. Patton really planned ahead for this. And instead of launching an artillery barrage across the other side of the river to push the Germans away, he just tells the soldiers to cross. And he puts an engineer in each of these wooden boats, and their job is to cross with the soldiers and then turn around and push the boats back into the river so there will be nothing blocking the follow-up troops. And then they're to all jump into one boat and paddle across the back and do the same thing again. And so within 24 hours, Patton has got almost two regiments across the Rhine River. He contacts Omar Bradley, tells him, I've beaten Montgomery across the Rhine River. He did it 24 hours before Montgomery's big attack. And it takes a little air out of the big offensive in the north and really adds to the Patton legend that, without any assistance where Montgomery was getting everything, Patton crosses the Rhine River first.
Well, okay, now the Germans know they lost the Battle of the Bulge. And they're getting squeezed into their own country. And here they are now. The Russians are coming in from the east. The Americans are coming on from the west. The prize is Berlin. They're about equidistant away. Here come the Russians. They're going to go in there and they expect a million casualties. Here's what I thought. And Professor McManus, you can comment on that the American army decided not to do that because the American public, I go back to what I said earlier about my parents and how they all felt, that they could not, the American people would not countenance that loss, the casualty loss. Tell us about that, Professor McManus.
Well, certainly any push for Berlin and fighting block to block in Berlin is going to be extremely casualty intensive. The Soviets ultimately are going to overrun Berlin and see it as the ultimate prestige objective in the war, which is, in my view, very, very questionable. So it's Eisenhower who makes the decision to, in effect, let the Soviets go in and take Berlin. And one of the things that factors into his decision is that he knew at previous high-level conferences, most notably Yalta in February 1945, the Allies had already agreed to zones of occupation in Berlin and then, of course, in Germany, which Berlin would be deep into the Soviet sector. So any ground you gain, you would simply have to give back to the Soviets anyway. So the Berlin decision was very controversial during the early phase of the Cold War, I'd say the first 25 years or so after World War II, and often seen by some as a mistake. Well, Eisenhower will stand by this decision his entire life, and when he ran for president in the 1950s, he will give some of those casualty estimates. They were not quite as high as what you mentioned. It would be, into six figures, though. And he would ask anyone in the audience to, if they wanted to volunteer a family member to die or be wounded, become a casualty in what would amount to just a prestige objective that would have to be given back. And this was a very, very powerful argument. And, of course, in light of what happens in the Cold War and the collapse of the Berlin Wall and communism in Eastern Europe, I believe Eisenhower was validated in every respect in that decision. But this is you know, there would be some, I suppose, who would dispute that even today.
Okay, that comes to Bob Gould's second big event in World War II would be instead of six-figure casualties in Berlin, somebody gave the order to go north and to go to Pimundi, and how huge was that to get Werner von Braun, a Nazi, an SS, he was a member of the SS, I mean, the guy was, well, wherever you want to label them, but to go there and to capture the scientists, to get the rockets, how huge was that? I mean, when you look at our military today, and you got to go back to Goddard, and you got to go back to Werner von Braun. Kevin, comment on that.
Sure. That was a highly sought-after prize by both the Soviets and the United States. Was to capture German rocket technology because it was so far advanced from anything either of the countries had. We were fortunate enough to get the scientists. The Russians got their hands on some rockets. We bought Werner von Braun and his crew of scientists to the United States, and they started working for the U.S. Army developing rockets. And when the Soviets launched Sputnik into space, it begins this big, now I wouldn't call it an arms race in space, but the space race is born. And for some reason, the president decides to go with Navy rockets, and they keep blowing up on the pad, and it's a great humiliation to the United States. And then the decision is made to go away from the Navy and to go with Werner von Braun's methods of developments of missiles going into space, and that is successful. And von Braun is then going to be put in charge, not in charge of NASA, but he's going to have a very prominent role in designing the rockets that are going to get American astronauts to the moon. That is an incredible legacy. He had dreamt about traveling to the planets as a child. This was always a dream of his. He wasn't a saint. He had Jewish slave laborers working in the rocket camps.
Thousands a day died.
Yeah, like I said, he was no saint. He was part of that Nazi system that employed slave laborers. The British and the Americans bombed their launch areas, but he really understood rocketry and what it would take to get out of the Earth's orbit to the moon. And so from this Nazi world that he was employed in and dropping rockets on Great Britain and in Antwerp, he becomes the pretty much key scientist to NASA and ideal in getting the United States to the moon.
We've got less than 2 minutes. I mean, I still got a ton to cover. We're not going to be able to cover that today. What I do want to, and you know what, folks, raise your hand. Why do you say we bring these guys back again?
Yay!
Oh, yay, there's Derek. And because we got to talk about all the rats that they all committed suicide except Bormann. And, oh, that's such an interesting story about Goering Anyway, so I'm going to give you boys a couple of chances to promote your books. Kevin, very quickly, we got about a minute and a half. Tell us about your books, The Photographs with Patton.
Sure. Patton's Photographs is a book of the photographs that General George S. Patton took himself personally throughout World War II. I discovered them in the Library of Congress back in 1996. It took me a number of years to get the whole collection together. I selected the best ones I could find, went to Patton's diaries and letters, found any references he made to taking pictures, put this wonderful book together. It was a labor of love, and anybody who reads it would make me happy.
Now, we've got something very quickly, The Dead and Those Are About to Die, Kevin McManus, that's coming out in paperback. Very quickly, you got the last word. You got 30 seconds.
Right. The Dead and Those About to Die, D-Day, the big roundup one at Omaha Beach, is coming out in paperback on May 5th. And if you'd like me to sign it or whatever else, just get in touch with me.
Okay, this is Bob Gould, Veterans Radio. Until next week, you are dismissed.